It's sad to say, but the presence of Nazis in Australia is, in the year 2025, an increasing concern, not least after the explicitly anti-Semitic neo-Nazi rally outside New South Wales Parliament on the 8th of November. And Nazis in Australia is the topic of an event in Melbourne this week, in which our next guests, Mark Ahrens and Graham Blewett, discuss the legacy of Australia's Special Investigations Unit. Now, that unit had a connection with ABC Radio National, as you can hear from this 1989 ABC archive snippet.
In 1986, Background Briefing put to air a series of programs that were so significant in their impact, they led to a special federal government inquiry. The series was Nazis in Australia, produced by Mark Ahrens. Subsequently, the government established the Special Investigations Unit to find out whether satisfactory cases existed against individual accused Nazis to warrant their prosecution.
That's the introduction to a repeat of the series, and here's how Mark Ahrens summarised its revelations at that time.
Britain was very active in rounding up and recruiting many of the people from Central and Eastern Europe who had so recently formed the armies of the Holocaust. They were wanting to use them as people who could be sent behind the Iron Curtain to help roll back Stalin's tyranny from Central and Eastern Europe. Now, when these operations failed, these people were an embarrassment to Britain in the main, but also to the United States, and they looked for places to dump them. Australia was one of the most popular dumping grounds. Once they were here in Australia, our authorities, our politicians, our security services knew all about who they were because they were busily resurrecting their fascist and Nazi movements here. And ASIO, for example, was busily penetrating them, protecting them, turning a blind eye to their resurrected Nazi organisations, and even encouraging and using them as anti-communist counterweights in migrant communities that were seen to be in the Cold War atmosphere too left-wing. And that's the practical reason why justice is so belated, why nothing has been done by our authorities, despite the fact that we knew that mass murderers were living amongst us.
That was Mark Ahrens in 1989, and I'm very pleased to say it's welcome back to ABC Radio National in 2025, Mark.
I'm very pleased to be here, Julia.
It's great to have you. And we're also joined by Graham Blewett, who worked at the Special Investigations Unit for five life-changing years and was its director from 1991 until it was shut down in 1994. Graham also went on to spend a decade as deputy prosecutor of the UN International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. So welcome to you also, Graham.
Thank you very much, Julian. Nice to be here.
Now, Graham, before we discuss the Special Investigations Unit, I wonder if you could speak to what you see as any connections or points of difference between the Nazis in Australia who are holding public protests in 2025 and those you were investigating in the late 80s and 1990s?
The main difference would be that those Nazis that we were investigating back in the mid-80s to the early 1990s came here trying to hide their past. They wanted to be seen as ordinary migrants, just fitting into the country, in their new country, and keeping their heads low. None of them, to my knowledge, were sort of propagating the Nazi regime's propaganda or their idealism. Rather, they just wanted to hide their past. Whereas I think what's happening now with the neo-Nazis, with their public demonstrations, I think they're just or sharing the same Nazi ideology and just trying to create havoc. They're not hiding, they're out in the open and seem to be proud of what they're doing. So to that extent, rather, I think there's a huge difference between the two groups.
And Mark, as we heard, it was your Background Briefing series that was crucial to the public momentum that led to the Special Investigations Unit being established. We're speaking now just after the 50th anniversary of the dismissal, and I gather that your Nazi hunting also has a bit of a connection to the dismissal, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. But I'd first of all just like to say something about what Graham just said, because I disagree. The Nazi emigres who came here, in fact, were very proud of their past. And they formed organisations, I think, as I said in my 1989 interview, so that, for example, the Croats formed Ustasha cells here, and the Slovenes formed Domobranci cells here, and the Estonians and the Latvians and Lithuanians, the White Russians, all of them had their own little groups. And they found a very warm welcome here because the Liberal Party, in particular, which was in power from 1949 to 1972, encouraged them. In fact, the very first president of the Migrant Action Committee, a Liberal Party committee, was a notorious Hungarian Nazi collaborator who had personally rounded up 14,000 Jews and dispatched them to Auschwitz, where they all were killed. So I think that Graham is being far too polite. But going to your question, I was in 1977 out investigating allegations made in a famous American trial about a Soviet spy in America who claimed that he knew for a fact that there were CIA connections to the dismissal. And I was out there as a young budding investigative reporter working on that case when someone said to me that, you think that's a scandal? You should investigate the hundreds of Nazi war criminals who were sent here by Britain in the United States. And I thought, wow, that's a story. And quite soon afterwards, a very senior journalist friend of mine by the name of George Degas actually introduced me to a senior police officer, a Commonwealth police officer, at Parliament House in Canberra, which was much more open in those days. You could walk in the front door, walk straight into the non-members bar, and you could walk up and down the corridors and knock on politicians' doors. And this senior police officer had, in fact, worked for Interpol as the Australian representative on it. And I asked him what he thought of that proposition, that hundreds of Nazi war criminals had been imported into Australia by British and American intelligence. And he laughed and said, that was well known in the circles that I work in.
And that really was the beginning of a life's work for you, Mark, and also not long after that for you too, Graham. Mark there described the number as hundreds. I wonder if, Graham, you could give us an overview of how many Nazis or Nazi collaborators ended up living in Australia in total and how those numbers played out in the work of the Special Investigations Unit.
I suspect that they were here in their thousands. At the time, after Mark's background briefing programs, the Menzies Review was set up, and Menzies came up with about 70 allegations against Nazi collaborators living in Australia. The SIU inherited those Menzies files, about 70, and at the same time, allegations were then coming in from the Soviet Union and from other sources. And by the time the SIU finished its investigations in 1992, we had investigated over 840 separate allegations. Most of those, about half of that number, couldn't be located or they were deceased, and the rest were in various categories of seriousness. And I think it came down to about, 36 or thereabouts, where the SIU was quite satisfied that there was sufficient evidence available to implicate them in war crimes. But it was only in a small handful of cases where we were able to get enough evidence that, in my view, would have been sufficient to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that they were, in fact, involved in Nazi war crimes and sufficient enough to bring them before the court and to stand trial. In the end, only three of them reached that stage. Three prosecutions were launched. And because of political interference, which no doubt Mark will talk about, Two others failed to proceed to prosecutions because of the interference of the Keating government at the time. So the numbers were quite extensive. 840 is not an insignificant amount.
And ultimately there were no convictions, is that right?
That's correct. One got to a jury, which in itself was quite remarkable, that we were able to survive the committal proceedings and get a case before a jury in the Supreme Court in Adelaide. That in itself was a significant event. But I think because of a number of reasons, including the behaviour of the trial judge, a lot of the prosecution evidence was not able to be led because the judge ruled it inadmissible. And I'm quite convinced in my own mind that had the jury heard all of that evidence, then a chance of a conviction would have been quite likely. One of the other cases, Heinrich Wagner, again, that was an extremely strong case. And just prior to the trial commencing, he suffered a heart attack and the Director of Public Prosecutions decided to withdraw the proceeding. So that case didn't proceed. I was quite angry at that stage that that had happened because my view was that we should have waited to see if Wagner would have recovered from his illness and would have been able to stand trial. But in the end, that did not happen, and he lived for another 10 years and was never prosecuted after he had his heart attack.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Graeme Blewett, who we heard from just there, and Mark Ahrens, who are both appearing in Melbourne this week to discuss the legacy of Australia's Special Investigations Unit. And Nazis in Australia is also the title of a book to which they've both contributed. Mark, if I could return to you, you mention in your book that there were indeed three extra episodes of Nazis in Australia that you never made. Why was that?
What happened, Julian, was that I had seriously avoided going to the Soviet Union in the production of the five-part series Nazis in Australia, because I knew that if I had done so, I would have been viciously attacked by the right wing for inducing evidence that would be tainted by Soviet methods. And after the program and after the Menzies review had actually confirmed the essence of our charges, you know, I decided to go to the Soviet Union. And I arrived there at the end of January 1987. And the Soviet Union was in one of its coldest winters in decades. And I didn't have any real warm clothes. What happened was that I worked with a young man called Andrei Bezrachenko, who was at that stage an employee of the Novosti News Agency, because no Western journalist was ever allowed to work in the Soviet Union without an overseer. And we first of all then went by train to Kiev, and then by small plane to Lvov, and then out into the outer reaches of the western half of Ukraine to a tiny little village where I ended up recording two giant peasants who had witnessed Ivan Polyakovich, who was the one case that went to full trial, who had witnessed him killing Jews, including some of their family members. And it was an amazing situation, because if you think about the process of getting the interview done in a foreign language, I had to ask a question in English, I had to get translated into Ukrainian. They answered it, had to get translated back to me. Then I asked my next question. By the time the first couple of questions and answers were done, I was absolutely frozen to the bone. I was shaking my arm because I was having to reach right up to their mouths. And one of them patted me on the head and said, "Oh, you should have been here yesterday. It was really cold." But I'll never forget, one of them started to cry. And before the tear had reached his cheek, it froze. That's how cold it was. I collected a lot of material about Politikos, and then I flew to Riga in Latvia, where I had a large number of interviews with men who had perpetrated the crimes, had been in jail for 20 years or more after the war, and who gave explicit evidence about the crimes of many of their fellow officers. And I arrived back in Australia in about late February, and I threw myself back into ABC work. And one day in early April, there was a message on my desk saying, please ring Bob Greenwood from the Special Investigations Unit. And I did that, and he said, well, you better come in tomorrow and see me. So I went down there, and he's a remarkable human being, Bob. He used charisma. He basically got straight to the point and said, what have you got for me then? And I explained that I'd assembled a lot of documentation and witness statements about my main target in the series. And then I said, oh, and I just got back from the Soviet Union a couple of months ago, where I interviewed a lot of people about some cases that might be of interest to you. And I said, I'm going to make some more programs later in the year about it. And he just looked at me and said, oh, well, look, I'd really like you to give me that material first. Then we'll talk about whether or not you're going to make another radio series. And I knew at that moment that I was never going to make those radio programs, because I knew how powerful the evidence was against at least four of the people who either should have been charged or were charged or would have been charged, except one of them died.
So we've heard about Mark's amazing trip to Ukraine. Graham, you also visited Ukraine as the director of the Special Investigations Unit. I wonder if you could speak a little about finding evidence 50 years after war crimes for a legal investigation rather than a journalistic one, and your assessment of, I suppose, the qualities and the limits of what was able to be obtained.
Sure. Julian, we had been trying to get into the Soviet Union to interview the witnesses, most of whom Mark had already identified, and we'd been trying to get in there for a couple of years, but the Soviet Union would not allow us to travel there. But Bob Greenwood, in his first mission to Moscow, was able to extract a memorandum of understanding from the Soviet procurators or prosecutors that would at some stage enable investigation teams from the SIU to get into the Soviet Union. And he was also able to get them to agree to allow their citizens to travel to Australia to give evidence in the event that prosecutions were launched. That was a major and significant event, and Greenwood was able to achieve that, notwithstanding Americans and the British and others, the Canadians, had tried to get such an agreement, but they were never able to pull it off. But because of Bob Greenwood's tenacity, his intelligence and his determination, he got that that agreement in place in writing, and so that was significant. And that then laid the groundwork for the SIU to enter the Soviet Union. And it's important to remember that this was prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it meant us travelling to Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus or White Russia to undertake our investigations. And the only way we could ever do that would be to enter the Soviet Union via Moscow. As I said, it took several months for that agreement finally to arrive. And in the summer of, their summer, in about June, July 1989, we finally got word that, yes, we could send a number of teams to the Soviet Union to interview the witnesses that had been identified, including those already interviewed by Mark. I joked with the head procurator in Moscow saying, well, that's fantastic news, but please don't let us suffer the same fate as Mark Ahrens by going there in the middle of winter. In the end, the joke was on us. See, we got approval to travel to the Soviet Union, and of course it was in December of 1989. Several teams had travelled to Moscow via London. We all arrived in Moscow in the middle of winter, and we were put on aeroplanes to Rovno, which is, I was part of that team that went to Rovno for our Ukrainian investigations, and separate teams went to Riga in Latvia and Vilnius in Lithuania. I think all of us, having experienced the Aeroflot flights, or Aeroflop as we call them, were so distressing that we all decided that we would never travel by Aeroflot again, and we usually traveled by train thereafter. But in any event, for the team that I was involved in, and our primary focus was Ivan Polyakovich, we arrived in Rovno. We formed a good working relationship with the local procurators, and they had organised a series of interviews over the following weeks where they would bring witnesses in to the procurator's office and we would interview them. Prior to going to the Soviet Union, however, there were still a lot of suspicions about the integrity of the Soviet witnesses. And the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, Mark Weinberg, had determined that it would be appropriate for us to videotape all of the interviews of the witnesses so that he would be able to assess whether or not there was any skullduggery going on in terms of their evidence. So we did that, and so all of our interviews were video recorded and audio recorded, and one by one we were putting the witnesses together, or their evidence together. When we'd finished in Rovno, we were then we travelled to Saniki, which was the village where the Jewish population had lived and who were executed by Polyakovich and his other Nazi collaborators and the Nazis themselves. And at the end of our six-week investigation in Rovno and Saniki, I was satisfied that we had enough evidence to implicate Polyakovich in the mass murder of the 550 Jews of Saniki. And we came back to Australia. I recommended to Bob Greenwood that the evidence, in my view, was sufficient. That went up the chain to Mark Weinberg. Weinberg himself was quite satisfied, although he needed to be convinced that there was, in fact, a mass grave. And one of the witnesses that we had seen in Saniki had taken us into a forest. He stood in the middle of this forest without any paths or laneways or signs or anything. It was just a bunch of trees. He walked into the forest, we followed him, and he reached a point, he turned around, got his bearings, and said, if you dig down here, you will find the mass grave. Of course, the forest had been grown some years after the execution. The pit was in a large field at the time, but following the executions, the grave was covered in, and at some stage, a forest was planted. So, Mark Weinberg wanted to be satisfied that there was, in fact, a mass grave there. So I got on the telephone and phoned my colleagues in Rovno and said, would you please go to Saniki and take this witness with you? His name was also Polyakovich, by coincidence. I think half the village was named Polyakovich. But Fyodor Polyakovich, our main witness, took the procurators back into the forest in the middle of winter, I might add. and they dug a hole, and sure enough, they found human remains, which was enough to satisfy Mark Weinberg that, yes, there was a mass grave there where this witness had said. And following that, Polyakovich was indicted and charged a few days later following his arrest by the SIU. And to establish that there was, in fact, a mass grave there, the SIU was then tasked with putting together an exhumation team. And the team went back 6 months later in the European summer and removed the trees, excavated the grave and discovered over 550 Jews of Saniki that had been murdered. And those investigations established the age and the sex of the victims, the manner of death, which in the main was a bullet to the back of the head. And we were able to discover various artifacts and items in the grave that established that they were, in fact, the Jews of Saniki. There were witnesses who still had the hair braids. We found an artificial leg and were able to identify that particular victim by name. We found bullet casings that had been recovered amongst all the dirt. And when we cleaned them up, it was established that they were of German manufacture in the late 1930s and 1941. And that established quite clearly that this was a Nazi mass grave rather than one of Stalin's graves from all of his purges. So in the end, that case went to court, and it followed on the great work that Mark had done. And I think the SIU established once and for all that it was possible to gather evidence 50 years after the event from crimes committed on the other side of the world and to bring Soviet witnesses to Australia to give evidence. And as I said earlier, the matter did end up before a Supreme Court jury in Adelaide.
Mark, you must have been disappointed that for all its work, the SIU didn't secure any convictions. Looking back on it now, what's your assessment of the significance and the legacy of the Special Investigations Unit?
Well, I would say, Julian, that disappointment was inevitable because the legal system really couldn't cope with it. And I think that Graham referred to the judge in the Polyakovich case. Well, I think that the judge was actually disgraceful because what he did was he looked at the prosecution case, saw what its strengths were, and systematically wiped them out. And so the jury never heard the real case. And for example, he disbarred the photo identification of a board that has a dozen photos on it. And what the SIU had done was take photos from the immigration files of Latvians of the same age, or roughly the same age, as Polyakovich. And he ruled that that was unfair on the accused because they all ought to have been from the same village, which would have been an absurdity because witness would have said, oh, yes, that's Ivan Polyakovich, but that's Fedor Polyakovich, and that's Katerina Polyakovich. And I would have just contaminated the evidence. So I was angry, but I went to the wind-up function of the SIU and was asked to give an impromptu speech. I ended by saying, I dips me lid to you all because they had done a fantastic job. They had forensically gone back and gathered evidence that was cold from people who were there and witnessed the crimes, some of whom were actually perpetrators, most of whom were survivors. And they gathered such intelligence that, as I say, I said to them, "Adis milid to you." But well, there was at least two or three cases that were really very badly mishandled. The principal one was about a man called Carlos Ozols, who had been an officer in the RIS Commando, which was a Latvian squad headed by a man called RIS. And Ozols had personally rounded up and participated in the murder of at least 30,000 Jews. And, statistics are a very hard thing to bear. But when you consider that they were all rounded up for one reason only, because they were Jews, and they were taken to mass pits, forced to undress, and then taken to the edge of the pit and shot in the back of the head. Or, even worse, they were made to lie head to toe and shot while they were lying down. And babies went into the pit alive and were buried alive. So this was a scandal, because the SIU had enough evidence that the DPP was prepared to put it forward as a prosecution. But just about a month before the Kenyan government was determined to close the unit down, they got information that colleagues, that they had discovered a file in Riga in the KGB archives that implicated Ozols in mass killings. And there were a number of witnesses to this, to these crimes. And Graham wrote to the then Attorney General, Attorney General Duffy, Michael Duffy, asking for an extension of time so that they could properly investigate this case. And it was a mark of why Labor, or how Labor, was determined to not allow any further investigations, but they turned him down, and for the want of $250,000 out of a $100 billion budget, he was allowed to live his life out. Mm-hmm. And eventually he joined 200 or 300 of his comrades buried in a massive memorial to the Estonian and Latvian SS out at Portland Cemetery in Melbourne. And there are other major mass killers amongst them.
Graham, obviously the theme of the book is that the SIU shouldn't be judged just on the lack of convictions in the end. What other achievements or contributions would you point to in support of that proposition?
Well, I think the most important thing was that we did establish quite clearly and strongly that it was possible to gather evidence in relation to war crimes committed in Europe 50 years after the event and to bring criminal prosecution. So for me personally, that gave me a lot of confidence that when the SIU closed down and I went to The Hague for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, I went there with no doubt in my mind that that UN tribunal could succeed. We basically did it in Australia. The things that stopped them, the Australian cases, from going towards prosecutions was the delay. Whereas in The Hague, the crimes were being committed while the tribunal was still operational, so all the crimes were fresh. So I went with that confidence, knowing that the UN tribunal could succeed. And I knew also that it would then depend upon the people that were there. And I was able to draw upon those Nazi war hunters who had worked with me in Sydney, together with my international colleagues in Canada, the USA, Scotland and England. I knew them all personally. I had trust in them. So I contacted these people and asked them, would you come to The Hague and help me get this thing off the ground? And thankfully, about 24 of them turned up in The Hague within the first 6 months of my arrival. So I was able to put together very, very quickly a team of experienced war criminal hunters who were all experienced in carrying out investigations. I brought Grant Neiman with me, who was the Commonwealth Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions and was involved in the prosecutions in Adelaide. So from the legal side and the investigative side, we were able to bring people that had that experience. And I think that was instrumental in how the tribunal got off the ground quickly. And in the end, we're able to bring all indictments, and in total, the 161 people were indicted by the tribunal, and all 161 of them ended up in The Hague to face prosecutions, at least those that were still alive. So to that extent, the ICTY, the Yugoslav Tribunal, was a 100% successful. And I think one of the reasons for that was due to the work of the SIU a decade before.
Mm. I think there's one other thing that really needs to be said, and that is that there are war criminals from much more contemporary wars here in Australia. Indeed, from where I am in southern Sydney, it's about a 3/4 hour drive out to southwest Sydney, where you'll find a Khmer Rouge man who has been identified by one of his victims. If you drive a little further north, you'll discover a couple of Afghan collaborators with the Soviets. They were very senior military and intelligence officers who were involved in slaughter of hundreds of people. And there are Chilean Dina here. There are people from Rwanda, from the Yugoslavian wars, of the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, as a scandal, because governments of both persuasions know all about it, but they do nothing. And I think that it's scandalous that the SIU was shut down, because at the time it was, Robert Greenwood said to the then Keating government, listen, we're going to be taking a lot of war criminals from the Yugoslav wars, and you need the SIU to get on top of the issue. And despite that, Keating just said, nah, you spent too much money.
That'll let it find. Sorry for the interruption there. I might just ask you, Mark, to say, so that we can clean up that closer. Could I just ask you to say, there's one other point I'd like to make, Julian, and so that I can cut in without me doing it, if that's all right.
There's just one other point I'd like to make, Julian, and it's about the fact that Australia has got hundreds of other war criminals from more contemporary wars here.
Great. That's perfect. And then we'll be able to cut the other bit in. So don't worry, we won't do a BBC on it. It'll flow right. And then I just need to say, so Graham Blewett and Mark Ahrens, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
The new book, Nazis in Australia, Exploring the Legacy of Australia's Special Investigations Unit, was compiled by Graham Blewett and edited by Mark Ahrens, and they're both appearing at the Melbourne Holocaust Museum on November 19. Thanks very much, Jens.
Fabulous.
Thanks, Julian. Thank you.
And so just to explain, obviously, for free-to-air broadcast, that we'll have to cut that down quite a lot, but a longer version will go out online after the radio broadcast goes out on Sunday morning.
Thanks, Julian.
I understand this.
Yes. But I really appreciate you, and I found it absolutely fascinating to read the book and to duck into the old ABC archives as well. So that was great.
Who is left in ABC radio archives?
Oh, I'm not sure who the maybe Isabel would know who the because most of my time has been in television, I came in relatively late, so I'm not sure we'd have much overlap there, Mark. But there's still good people doing good work. Not quite the impact perhaps that you had. But I'm sure we all love Radio National.
Oh yeah, do we never? Yeah,
absolutely. Well, thanks again, gents. All the best.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers then. See you.
And I'll see you in Melbourne, Mark.
Yeah, have a great night.
Exactly.
Cheers. See ya.
Travel safe. Bye bye.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.